Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 24th of April, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talking about Salt Lake Potash, EnQuest Retail Bond, Fidelity Global Technology Fund, and Bluefield Solar Income Fund. Also on the podcast, Ian Murphy, full-time trader and author of Way of the Trader, a complete guide to the art of financial trading, talks about his new book, now available in hardback. And also, Darren Sinden, market analyst at Pepperstone Limited, talks about US equities, now that we're into fall earnings season, how that might fit into the US Q1 GDP data out Friday, and also inflation in Australia and the knock-on effect of that. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, as always, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see articles on other companies like Boohoo, this thing about gold here, and global central banks accelerate gold buying spree. Oh, interesting. Taking Stock with Zach Meir, worth watching. It's a video where Zach covers macro, micro, in a video, in all his splendor and glory. There's an article on Sea Machines, plus plenty of other stuff, content there. VoxMarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You all right, Al?
Yeah, Justin, I'm fine, thanks. Recovering after a weekend at a wedding in Ireland and everything that goes with that, which includes the Guinness, of course.
Yeah, well, I did see a couple of pictures there and out there for a wedding. Again, I hope your missus didn't find out, did she? Who's the lucky lady you're marrying?
No, it was a friend of it was my daughter's best friend, actually, and some old family friends. Their daughter got married, met a chap, and very nice guy is too. Family's great. So, we had an Airbnb place out there south of Dublin, trawled around the Wicklow Mountains on Monday and had a great time, yeah. And the wedding was over the weekend. Fantastic weather, of course. I mean, the weather's just been amazing.
It was, unusually. It's almost like... I think every now and again, whoever's in charge of the weather says, come on, we've punished them enough for bank holidays. Let's give them one in a while. Let's give them a nice bank holiday, you know. So that happened there. But, yeah, cool. You know, I didn't have a particularly rough one, but I don't know why I found it hard to recover from that. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't find it hard to get back into the routine, even though it was a couple of, you know, what, 4 days, I suppose. But I found it hard to get back in the routine. I did not sleep on Monday evening. I went to bed at 9 p.m. I woke up, because I get up at 4:30 anyway, and I woke up at 11 p.m., 2 hours sleep. I could not go back to sleep. In the end, I was rolling around for like 3-4 hours in bed. I just got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I felt like a zombie all day yesterday, really dreadful. But
Well, I was fine over the weekend, and of course we had the yesterday, so we flew back late yesterday afternoon. So of course Guinness all the way, which does help you sleep. Last night I had the same problem. I think getting back into work. Well, getting back today, and obviously getting back into things. But it's very quiet anyway, isn't it? I mean, the markets aren't exactly alive with news and rumour.
As I look now, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stocks down. No rises. I think they're having a hard time after the bank holiday weekend as well. What are we chatting about? What stocks are we looking at, Al?
Okay, well, I want to do a combination of stocks and funds. We've of course discussed funds in the past, Jess, and there are some. I think we tend to focus very much on small cap stocks here and where the opportunities are, and obviously there are some terrific growth opportunities. So I'm going to focus on one stock today that isn't a micro cap anymore. It's moving into graduated up to being a small cap. But also want to talk about the EnQuest retail bond, which offers nearly 8% running yield, and also the Vitality Global Technology Fund, and also just to touch again on the Bluefield Solar Income Fund that we discussed in the past, and there's a couple of other little companies and developments I want to talk about too. But if we start with Salt Lake Potash.
Yeah, cool, let's go for it. I'll when you get on the funds, I've adjusted my fund holding a little bit, which we'll chat about. But go for it. What's happening? Salt Lake Potash.
Okay, so we're seeing a lot about the small potash companies in the news for various reasons. Obviously, Sirius Minerals is in the news, probably not necessarily for the right reasons, but nonetheless, I think they've been largely responsible for really putting potash on the map for investors. And we have other smaller companies around as well. You've spoken with Hayden Lockett, Emerson, of course, and there is a company in that operates in Western Australia called Salt Lake Potash that I have discussed before. The epicode is SO4. Okay. Now, what's different about Salt Lake Potash? Salt Lake Potash have 11 lakes or 11 lake projects in total across Western Australia, which are dried salt lakes, as the company name would infer. And there's a harvesting process that entails building a brine pit and distilling down the salts that are harvested from the service, and from that they extract SOP, which is premium sulfate of potash, rather than the muriate of potash, which sells for a low amount of money.
I last time I had the guys on from sulfate of potash, they're saying obviously there's more. It's a better sort of potash. So sulfate of SOP is a premium potash fertilizer, free of chloride, unlike MOP, which is harmful to plants. So it's SOP is primarily used in high value crops, and because of that, it's a bigger margin, price there, you know.
Bigger margin, bigger price, but also a much bigger market too, because of course sustainability is what it's all about nowadays. So you've got a clean product that can be used to grow plants and grow crops across the world that doesn't have any nasty side effects. And the beauty of the Salt Lake Potash project is that it has probably the lowest operating costs of any company around the world in production. So currently 70% of Salt Lake or SOP production loses money because it costs, with the existing processes, around $400 a ton, and SOP is currently selling for about $450 a ton. SO4 can produce at around $200 to $250 a ton. So, you know, you've got 50% margin there straight away. Now, I mentioned it has 11 lakes, 11 lake projects. Just one of those lakes, Lake Way, they are currently building a demonstration plant, and there was a fundraising at the start of the year in order to do this. As a result of the investigation into the lake and the surveys that have taken place, the mineral resource estimate has been upgraded to 81 million tons of SOP, which, do the math, at $450 a ton, that's many billions of dollars worth of product. the fundraiser was also the money was also raised to build a demonstration plant at a Williamson pit to which is the brine pit from which the SOP is distilled. And following the company, in fact, the CEO Tony Swierczyk said the other day that the Lakeway project is progressing well. We pushed a complete train one and commenced dewatering the Williamson pond. Full steam ahead, progressing to plan. So it's on schedule. The company said last year that it expected to be producing revenues from one of the lakes in 2020. So that's still on schedule to happen, which is extremely exciting. Let's look at the CEO, Tony Swierczyk. He's ex-Fortescue Metals. He's overseen major projects and indeed he was one of the mining projects at Fortescue Metals was transformed under his leadership. So he's got a great track record in the industry. And as I say, this is just one. Lakeway is the first of 11 lakes. There's over 5,000 square kilometres that the company can potentially harvest in the coming years. And this has been recognized by fund manager Lombard Odier, who have increased their stake from the start of about 5%, currently holding just under 12% of the company. So on the back of the potential and the success, the company has struck joint ventures and takeoff agreements already with the Chinese fertilizer giant Sinofert, also Mitsubishi as well. It has solid support from the government of Western Australia. So everything is in place for this company to transform. It's currently worth $63 million. The shares are traded as high as 37p on the year, as low as 23p. Currently trading at 30p. But as I say, just go back. You've got a mineral resource estimate on Lakeway, 81 million tons of SOP, which is selling the market for $450 a ton. SO4, the salt lake product, can produce that at $200 to $250 a ton. That's just one of 11 projects. So I think this company is extremely exciting. And I think in terms of growth potential, it's got greater potential than pretty well any other potash company out there in the market right now.
Wow, Al. Wow. It's a big statement coming from you, fella.
Well, it is, yeah, but it's all there. I mean, if you go to, you can go to Brand UK and look at Salt Lake Potash and look at the pages there. There's a link directly to the latest company presentation, or just go to the RNSs, look at the latest company presentation. It's all there. I mean, the math is pretty straightforward to do. And also the harvesting process, it's just a lake. The pit's dug, it's a really simple, straightforward process. The company's on schedule to deliver what it says it's going to do. So I do anticipate, and clearly, as we know, caveat, shares go down as well as up, but I do see great potential in this company, and I think there's enormous growth potential. Once they get Lakeway on schedule, then they can repeat the process on the other lakes, and you know, we could have a multi-billion dollar company on our hand.
Do you hold any stock?
I do. I'm invested.
I'm glad you do. I'm making that statement now. If you didn't hold any stock, I said, what's he talking about? That's like a CEO comes on the podcast. I often get this. CEOs come on the podcast, talk about the company for ages, saying how much potential they've got. And I check the shareholder register. They're not even on there. I think, well, hang on a second. You are, if you are a CEO, pretty much you're a corporate person, you know? You're in it for the money. Okay, you maybe have ambition to get some kind of project going. But you like money, essentially. You know, you wouldn't be a CEO. Yeah. You wouldn't push yourself up the corporate ladder. So the fact that you don't buy shares and yet you say there's good potential to earn lots of money from investing in the company, to me, just smacks of a lie. And I think there's a quality filter now. And often one slips by the way when I'm investing. I look at it, I like the company anyway, and I think it's got potential. And I'll sort of ignore the CEO not holding. But do you know what? It's always good to have the CEO aligned with shareholders because they are acting as a shareholder as well as a corporate guy. You know what I mean? So, it's one of those filters. When I've seen companies that go wrong, they haven't performed, and I go back, it's happened a couple of times, and I go back and look, I think, do you know what? The CEO didn't have a major skin in the game. They made a big mess up there, and they didn't have skin in the game. They underperformed. And do you know what? I feel if their money was on the line, they wouldn't have underperformed, you know? But indeed. So anyways, could you have skinned the game? Because obviously a big talk up there, but the big step in the end. But like I said, you're right. It's all risk and reward. I think people by now should know, listening to the podcast, these are ideas. Yep. Ideas can be good and bad. They may play out, they may not. So do your own research. All right.
Well, in SO4, I bought shares at 30p. I also bought shares when at 24p as well. So you know.
Let's have a look at the share price. So the share price at the moment is at 31. It's okay. So. In the last year, since 2008, pretty much hasn't moved a lot, has it?
Hasn't moved a lot. No, that's right.
What I'm saying is it's gone between sort of a range of like 22 pence and 32 pence, pretty much. So we're at the top end of the range at the moment. But it's if it breaks out through there, we could see a move because it hasn't done that for a while, really. It's got 35 pence last April.
Yeah, I'd urge investors wanting to look at this that there's a lot of information on the company website. There's a great company presentation. And like I say, I mean, Tony Swerzek, you can follow him on Twitter and also Salt Lake Potash on Twitter as well. And you get the updates from there. But there's the company is just getting on with the job. It's raised the money. It's getting on with the job of building this pit. And it's very exciting. I mean, and they've got good access to road, rail and ports as well. I think there's... it's going to be a transformational year for them. But clearly, there's a risk, shares go down as well as up. But I am invested here, and I'm also invested in the funds I'm going to talk to you about next as well.
Okay, cool. What is it?
Okay, so the first one, this is actually a retail bond. Investors will be aware of the
boring
company. EnQuest.
Are you kidding?
Okay, so EnQuest is the oil exploration company that has interests in the North Sea and elsewhere. I'm not going to go in great detail into the company.
Good.
It's rather the actual mechanism that I'm interested in here. Now EnQuest itself, the shares in EnQuest don't pay a dividend. So the opportunity for a retail bond was flagged up by a gentleman that publishes articles on the branduk.net website regularly, Ken Baksh.
I thought you said in the pub then. The guy just down the pub told me. Okay.
And the pub too. Yes. Yeah,
I went straight back home and bought some stuff and on the advice of the guy in the pub. I forget his name now, but...
I've sat in the cross keys on Bishopsgate with Ken Baksh on several occasions. We have discussed this in the pub as well. But so EnQuest issued a retail bond with a 7% coupon and the bond has been trading... the bond's been trading at it was trading just under £80 a unit when I bought it, and it's currently at 80, it's 87 to sell, 89, well just under 90 to buy. So there's a running yield, as I say, 7.89%. And the thing is, with bonds, of course, you're lending the company money, and it will repay that money subject to certain criteria. The oil price has got to be a certain level, and that coupon is paid out twice a year. But what attracted me was that I had some money in my SIP, and if you buy this bond, retail bond, within your SIP, the capital gain and the coupons that are paid out from this are all sheltered from tax. So clearly, if you're looking for a tax efficient investment, this is something that should be considered. So clearly, EnQuest is a play on oil exploration, and there were some major developments of the company recently that supports further ongoing growth. The EPICO, by the way, I should say, is ENQ1. So if you're, I don't know which broker you're with, but if you go onto the Hargreaves Lansdown website, for instance, there's plenty of information on there under the EPICO ENQ1. But I'm holding this. Already had one payout this year. That's gone into the SIP, and there's another one due. So I'm going to sit on this and see where it goes. Matures in 2022. But if you like the idea of EnQuest, but you don't like the idea that you're not going to get a dividend, but you want to expose yourself to a bit more risk, potential for capital gain and an income too, this is a great little vehicle.
Yeah, well, listen, if we're going into funds now, like I said, I keep saying about the IUKD iShares is BlackRock, of course, biggest investment house in the world. And it's an ETF, so it trades like a share, but it's a fund. It's an exchange-traded fund. That means it's exactly like a share. It's on the exchange, on the market. So you get a quote, you get an instant quote and buy shares straight away. Unlike other funds that are not ETFs, you have to wait. I think you can buy daily, I think. So you put an order in, you get it the next day or something. But and they won't move that much. Right. But iShares, it holds 50 of the biggest and safest dividend-paying stocks in the FTSE 350. So you've got all the companies like, Royal Dutch Shell, Bats, all the big guys like that, Persimmon, all those kind of people. And they are checked, for sustainability of dividend payments and dividend coverage as well. So rather than having to do individual, assessments on companies, which I can't be bothered. I find it really boring looking at dividend cover. Oh, I forgot how much dividend cover they got. I don't care about that. It's so it's boring. I'm really not excited by that stuff. So I got a chunk in iDividend, and I'll be, and of course, at the moment, it's paying about 6.6%, and that's spread, that's paying on a quarterly basis, so that's spread across four quarters. And so you get a regular payment on that. But also, it's at 7.90 now, the prices, the share price of the UK. And it went down to 7.20 in that big sell off last quarter in 2018. And that was a 7-year low. So this is why, if you want capital growth and dividend payments, this, I think, around about this level is a good level. It may retest that low again if it sells off, but it's not far off a low, so I assume I'll get half decent payment income, and then I'll hopefully once all the rubbish is, I'm a bit bearish, but I just don't care at the moment, because if it goes down, obviously the yield goes up, but I mean if it goes up, the share price goes up, the capital upside as well, so I think it's a win-win situation here, and it's relatively safe, of course. And I find it poor that children are not educated about things, or people generally. It's like people will put their money in a bank. They're a couple of grand. Put them in a bank. Get nothing on it. No return. In fact, it'll be eaten away compared to what inflation is, pretty much. Yeah. So it's less than inflation. So you're losing money on that. And yet people are not educated about sort of funds, which are, they say they're
whatever
risky. Say they're risky as an equity. They're not as risky as you think, because most of the companies you invest in are bigger than the bank you invest in, pretty much. Well, Royal Dutch Shell are.
Whatever you do, the golden rule is to beat inflation. If you can always beat inflation, then your money's growing in real terms. That's the important thing. And
I thought the golden rule was treat others as you'd like to be treated. But yours is beat inflation, is it?
The second
silver rule is treat others as you'd like to be treated.
Calm and treat people the way you'd like to be treated. Exactly. No. That's the thing, Jesse. And clearly, you're investing sort of to grow your money, and also to provide an income for you in later life, or now, or to create the financial freedom for you in your current life, and that's the important thing. And these vehicles all offer that they're not without risk. But I agree, it's astonishing how poorly people are educated, and how they're just happy to stick their money in the bank and accept a measly fraction of a percent, and think it's somewhere safe to park their money. You've got to be adventurous in this game. You've got to grow your investments, and certainly the Enquest retail bond is working for me. Another one that has worked very well, I invested into, we mentioned these are pure funds now, and clearly when you buy the fund there's a delay as your order has to be placed into the market. But I bought the Fidelity Global Technology Fund, the accumulation fund rather than the income fund, which means the units or your income is reinvested into buying more units. I bought this fund just under 2 years ago, and it's up 52% already. But I think more important than that is the actual performance over the past 5 years. 14 to 15, 35%, 15 to 16, just 8%, 16 to 17, 46%, 17 to 18, 14.5%, 18 to 19, 31%. So, that's pretty solid. Now again, as you said, can't be asked to do the research, but this fund invests in the top technology and telecom stocks. holds its biggest holding is Apple, 6.4%, Samsung, 5.5%, Alphabet, 4.7%, Intel, IBM, Microsoft, SAP.
Okay, Ali, you don't want to list all of them, are you?
Yeah.
You listed NASDAQ 100.
It's the top holdings. So you want a basket of shares that. You can't be asked to do the research. This is a great way to do it. And it's one of my best performing funds. You know, it's right up there. And
that's a good one. I like that. Do you know what I did recently, though? I had two funds, ETFs. One was Robot, RBOD, investing in automation, IT, and robots. And one which I looked at, which is the best performing pretty much tracker over the last 30 years, is the NASDAQ 100. So it just looks at the top 100 stocks in the NASDAQ. And I realized when I looked at them, I bought them together recently. I've had them about a month or so now. And they've both done quite well, but you know, in a month, they're over 5%, I think close to 7%, 8% in a month. But they're tracking each other pretty much. And I realize a lot of the companies in the robot thing are in NASDAQ. So I've sold the robot and I'm just sticking with the NASDAQ. And unlike the dividend thing, it's at quite a high at the moment, the US market. So I'm not going to buy any more on that. I'll be buying on dips. And I did highlight this strategy in a video I did on RSI sell-offs. But I'll be buying when it sells off. But yeah, again, you know, that one you've got, the technology fund, it's probably very similar to the NASDAQ 100 thing that I've got. Because, you know, all the tech companies, that are, you know, the big ones, are in that top 100 NASDAQ, aren't they, you know?
Well, they are, yeah. That's and this is global technology, so the best global or the very cream of the global technology stocks this company invests into, and it's got a great long-term track record too. You can also invest into the income stock as well, where you get an income which is paid twice annually. And I think in this situation, you know, technology is exciting. You can get the growth. I believe also Pinterest that had its stock exchange debut the other day was up 24%, 25% this first day, and I think they also took a slice of that too. So
yeah, Zoom was a big move. I don't know if it's in there, but so by the way, that's so how do you look for just search that, because this one, like the iShares NASDAQ, has a ticker, of course it's an ETF again, so it's trade like a share, you know, so you just search for CNDX. CNDX is the ticker for iShares NASDAQ if you want to look at that. So it's a good performing fund. But okay, year to date, up 21%. That's good, isn't it?
That's very good. That's very good indeed. And year to date, global Fidelity Global Technology up 30.
Okay, Al. So. All right.
Even better.
Yeah, that's due a pullback now, though, that one is.
It's due a pullback, yeah. No. But that's the thing. It's consistent performance over the past 5 years, and that's it. I think the HL, Hargreaves Lansdown website, is very good for researching funds, but with a caveat, they have their Wealth 150. And I'm a little skeptical of this because I believe the Wealth 150 tends to favour the funds that probably pay a higher commission. But that's just my view. I'm probably wrong. But the Fidelity Global Technology Fund is not recommended by Hargreaves as one of their top 150, and yet the performance there is clear to see. You know, and also Fidelity are a giant fund manager. They know what they're doing. And if you believe in the growth of technology and it'll continue, and this fund is well managed, then I can't see.
Don't say it.
Not any reason not to be in here.
Well, there's risk everywhere else.
If you want an element of technology in your portfolio, this is probably one of the best ways to do it. But that's my own view.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hang on a second. So what's so what has been that cumulative performance there on your thing? Can you see it? Cumulative.
Yep. So the cumulative, we just got it on a year-on-year basis.
iShares have all that, and they have cumulative as well.
If I go to the chart, hang on a second, I'm just putting this up now. So the units were, so from 0% in April 14, so we're up 220%. So that's pretty good.
And when, 2014?
Yeah, April 2014 to date, we're up 220%.
That is very good. Yes, definitely getting there with some exposure to that, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know when this was their inception, this one, but in the last 5 years it's done 110, but inception is 330%. So, yeah, I mean, both decent. And they're, like I said, relatively low risk, aren't they? You know, so.
Well, they are.
But,
yeah.
Again, but you've got to look at the, you know, where the market is. You're not buying, buying at the top because that could come back and you could be sitting on a loss there for ages. So you've still got to time it a little bit. You know, use a bit of market timing. Wait for a big sell off, then top up. You know.
Or indeed. Well, in the noughties, I invested into two funds, the BlackRock Golden General, which gave me a great return. Again, that was 50% over about 3 or 4 years. And the Alliance Brickstars Fund, which was very poor, and I sold at about a 35% loss. I just thought, no, I'll put this into stocks and I'll get my money back. So that was a learning curve there. But you've got to pick and choose. But the research tools are out there to do it, so it is worth looking around. But again, you know, just look at the long-term track record and look at the dips and try and see if those dips related to a market correction or something else, and then you
right.
can
we're talking too much now. I've got a guest waiting next. We've got to go quickly. Let's go for the last one. Sorry, it's a guest Skype me saying I'm on next. Yeah, we're gonna be late.
Okay.
Let's go for it. One,
all right. Very quickly, another fund I talked about, Bluefield Solar Income Fund, BSIF. This is an exchange-traded fund, again, offers a 5.5% dividend yield, BSIF. We've spoken about this, and again, this fund just keeps on growing. It's a slow, steady grower, but actually, if we from April last year, it was trading at 1.17. Today, it's trading at 1.36 with a 5.5% dividend yield, steady grower. And this fund invests into UK solar power projects up and down the country. So it's a nice fund. It's got a green element to it, and it's a steady dividend payer. So that's it.
Yeah, it's a green element, even though it's called Blue Star Solar. So that's good. There's a lot of color stuff in there. So
yep.
Do you know what? Green for a long time, and renewables have been on the edge of mainstream investing. I believe now it's coming into the mainstream. It will do the next few years. I mean, everything's headed that way. So, it's a sea of change happening. There's, momentum's behind that. And so that's what I'm looking at. When I'm looking at investing now, I'm looking at everything from plastics, water reduction, all that kind of stuff, because I do genuinely think, you know, like I said, even you know, if you know, we saw last night, I didn't see it, someone told me about it, but there's a Beyond Meat has just listed, was about to list in America. And I've seen, about a year back, I was looking to get exposure to vegan because I thought, this is going to be big. It's not a fad. And I tell you why it's not a fad. It's because we got a water problem in the world, right? And like I said, even the head of environment said in 25 years' time, we'll be having no, UK will be in trouble water wise because at the moment our demand is outstripping supply. In 25 years' time, we'll have sucked up all the aquifers. There'll be no new reservoirs coming on stream. So, and if you look at it, the biggest user of water is agriculture and livestock. So, and down to health reasons, and this is not just basically pro vegan thing, but the Western world eats about a third too much meat daily, so we have to cut down on that, and also that helps the environment as well. So I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure on this, and so there's lots of alternatives going on. And this thing, Beyond Meat, they're listing for over $1 billion in the US. I saw reviews, they sell it in Tesco's. I haven't tried any, but it looks fantastic. The reviews saying, there's no reason to eat beef anymore. This is fantastic. It's like, and their burgers look real. They've even got a steak that sort of bleeds. And it's unbelievable. I think, given the choice of people, they say, if you could eat something that tastes exactly as good, but doesn't involve cruelty to animals or killing animals, and it saves the environment, people would go with that, wouldn't they? Surely. So I'm just thinking, that kind of exposure is worth getting. Yeah. I think veganism and vegetarianism is a huge market as well. And we've just seen this tip of the iceberg here, and that iceberg is melting due to global warming now.
Well, you're right. No. I think the vegan movement is very much on the up, and I know when we saw it last time, you mentioned a chain of vegan restaurants that were opening up, and even on the trip to Ireland, that was very evident as we travelled around, particularly around Dublin. You know, there's a big vegan movement going on. Lots of posters, lots of banners, and there are campaigns, major mainstream advertising campaigns by these upcoming brands. So I'm absolutely with you. I mean,
do you know what? One of the biggest investors in this Beyond Meat is Tyson Foods, apparently, which is one of the biggest meat producers in America, plus also Bill Gates. And so you see the bit of money behind that, you know, one of the richest guys in the world. Marvellous stuff. I'll better go because I've got someone knocking my Skype door, my proverbial Skype door. So better let them in. Marvellous stuff, that. Thanks for that, Al. We'll speak next week.
Thanks, Just. Speak next week. Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is full-time trader and author of Way of the Trader, A Complete Guide to the Art of Financial Trading, is Ian Murphy. Ian, thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm an investor, you're a trader, and I suppose the difference is time frame, pretty much, is that right? And what you, I mean, and I hold shares in company, you don't so much, do you?
Yeah, there's a number of differences between traders and investors, as we discussed the last day. I think the markets being traded, the instruments being used, and the time frame that you're in a trade very much differentiate. And as well, traders tend to concentrate on one instruments, particularly liquid instruments, you know, maybe geared ETF or futures, and they stay with that. And they'll often repeatedly trade the same instrument, whereas an investor should be always looking to diversify their portfolio, even within the stock segment of their portfolio, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, take us, before we get into the book, and now it's out, you can buy it right now on Amazon. Before we last chatted a while back, it was just available in a sort of e-book, but now it's out on Amazon and all the other sort of resellers and stuff like that, so it's in proper book form. But before we, you know, get into it, just give us a bit about your background, when you started, how long ago, how long it took you to become sort of, you know, a full-time trader, because it's very much trial and error. People mistake this, don't they? I mean, people think they can just jump into the markets and start earning money, you know, and no other profession is like that. In no other profession would you just jump in and think you can do it. You wouldn't just, you know, walk into a clinician's surgery or theatre and just think you can crack on with it, or just join Wimbledon, you know, in the semi-finals. Or you can just, it takes ages to learn, doesn't it?
Yeah, the example I use in the book is if you think of the legal or the medical profession, and when new entrants come into that profession, you know, if they expect to be profitable and have a big client base from the outset, they're going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. And there's also an expectation that you have to go through, you know, a learning process. You have to go to university and study, because they're entering a very complex and multifaceted environment, a profession. Yeah. Trading is exactly the same. It's a very complex environment. The professionals who are already in there, the institutions, they know what they're doing. They know where the money is, and they're plugged into the money flow. And they're going to continue to let it flow to them if they can. So in some ways, you have to kind of elbow your way in or nudge your way into the profit stream.
Yeah. And in your book there, you have, you know, a lot of titles there. One is Preservation of Capital. And I suppose that's very important when you're trying to find your own style, because everyone, and I found this with investing, it took me ages. For a long time, you sort of, you know, look up to other people and try and copy the way they're doing something. And that's very handy, you know, looking to follow other people. But you'll never really be successful until you're comfortable with your own style. Isn't that the case?
I actually don't believe, Justin, you can follow other people's trades. I have experience of this where I've worked with traders. We've both seen the same trigger. We've both taken them using our own, you know, risk profile, and we've had wildly different results. And often entering on a Monday or entering on a Tuesday can have a big difference. And also, if a trade is running, I'm particularly a trend follower. And if people scale in and out of a trending position, or if they increase their position as it goes, it can have vastly different results at the end. I actually write in the book that trying to trade somebody else's idea is like trying to comb your hair while looking at their reflection.
Because that's a good analogy. You know, and I see this all the time on Twitter, right? Twitter's a very good area of arguing, and people will follow the other people's investments, and they'll lose money or something. And I often say, I do videos once a week on stocks that I've bought and just doing updates. And I said, you know, don't invest on this. This is just information. You don't know what, you know, level of money I've got in here, what percentage of my portfolio I'm exposed to this company. You don't know at what time I got in. You have no idea. It's completely different for me from you. I like it because of these reasons. I may be biased because I'm already in. And so you're right there. It is, you know, trying to brush somebody else's hair in the mirror. I know it's ridiculous. I know you've got to find your own way, haven't you?
You see, ultimately, without getting too profound, ultimately you are your own opponent when you trade. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to realize this, because the market constantly provides opportunities for profit. It's to recognize those opportunities and to take them when they arise. But they're your personal opportunities based on your trading style, based on your experience, and based on the capital you have at your disposal and the risk tolerance you're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And all of those variables can only work with you and your account and the market you're trading. Mm-hmm. So that's why following others' ideas, it never works out. And you know what, Justin? It's also kind of counterproductive, because you never learn anything. Yeah. And eventually all traders go through a drawdown, And it's a matter of preserving your capital at all times so the drawdown doesn't inflict, you know, terminal damage on your account. If you're following someone else and they enter their drawdown, you're completely lost.
Yeah.
Because at that point, the trader is either sitting in cash or scrambling for solutions. Yeah. And then you are just completely lost. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a system that I use all the time. And in fact, right above my head here, laminated in front of me, is an acronym, CASH. And there's two C's in it, three S's, each letter obviously stands for something. And I try and filter every company I buy through that system. You know, they won't all meet, they won't tick every box, but if they tick the majority, then I know it's a good start. And I assume you have a kind of filter as well?
Yeah, I have a number of standard processes and procedures that I use. And really, when I set out to write this book, Way of the Trader, Justin, I wanted to write the book that I wish I'd read when I started trading.
Yeah.
Because it's not like in trading there's this great secret or this great edge that, you know, you get it and you can't share it with anybody. It doesn't work like that. It's, you know, it's like rain falls impartially on everybody. You just have to put out a bucket and catch it. And the market is like that. It just radiates opportunities. And it's up to you to capitalize on them and use them. And so there is no real edge. There's no secret. It's just about the psychology of trading, realizing you're ultimately trading against yourself. It's about discipline and patience. And, you know, I thought a lot about what could you compare trading to? What other profession would be an indication of what it's going to be like? And people often think of a professional poker player, but I don't think that's a good analogy. I think a professional stand-up comedian is actually the best analogy, and I'll tell you why. Because with a comedian, everything revolves around one single issue. The comedian is either funny or not. Nothing else matters. Their appearance, how they look, how they sound, what they do, it's all irrelevant. They're either funny or not.
Yeah.
Likewise, a trader can either pull money out of the market or not. You know, we all talk about strategies and we all have our psychology and the markets we trade and the tools we use. None of that really matters. What matters is at the end of the year, is your account up or down? And can you do that consistently every year?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's when people go into trading, or you know, people who've been around the markets a while even, they concentrate on the technical end of it. They concentrate on technical analysis, fundamentals, the technology of their trading platform, backtesting strategies and all this. People who come to trading are quite clever. So they get the technology end of it quickly, certainly within a few months. But the part where the money is made and lost, the psychology, they continue to struggle with that for years. And many of them never address it. Or they say, it's so big and kind of vague, cloudy type of a concept, I don't even know where to begin. And also, to progress with the psychology in trading, you've got to work on yourself, not on the laptop in front of you, because that's easy to just play around with charts and graphs. But when you've got to work on yourself, accept that you don't have patience, accept that you lack discipline, accept that you're afraid when you shouldn't be, they're the most difficult things to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just in the markets. This manifests in all areas of our lives. Nobody wants to accept that they're wrong or change ingrained habits we've had all our lives. And unfortunately, we bring those into the market with us when we trade. We put a price on that because every time we trade, we're putting money into the market and we're paying for market answers. We're paying to know where the market will go next.
Yeah.
And we end up losing that money.
Yeah. Do you know what? I see this every time. I'm like it as well. Everyone's like you said. When I invest in a company, I want so hard for it to be right. I almost deny there's anything wrong with this investment. But I honestly believe that. I mean, when I can actually take a position in a company and be completely unbiased and accept criticism in that investment from somebody else, that's when I become a better investor. Because, you know, it's so hard. You know, when you put money in, basically, you're pinning a stake on it. You're basically saying, this is me, I got to be right here. But it's being unbiased, isn't it? And objective. If you can be objective and place that, it could go either way here, then I think we'll be a better investor trader, you know?
Yeah, and there's two things there. Number one, you shouldn't expect the instrument you're investing in, whether it's a stock or futures or option, to act in a rational manner.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, you may have done your homework and all the ducks may line up, but the market may go somewhere where nobody expected, and that's never wrong. Yeah. And the second thing is, when you're trading, what you're actually doing is running a small business that trades in risk, because that's what we're doing. You know, every time we trade in a stock, for example, that price is based on expected future earnings. And right now we're in the middle of earnings season, for example, and the States earnings for the first quarter, January, February, March, will start to come in now in mid-April because they've had 2-3 weeks to do the books, and they'll flow in for another month. So right now there's an enormous price adjustment going to take place over the next few weeks in the markets, because all stock prices are based on expectation of future earnings. So the previous expectations have now to adjust to the current reality, and the whole expectation process begins again for the next 3 months. But the problem there is the earnings announcements coming out at the moment are based on the previous 3 months trading in the firm now, not trading the markets. And you can't trade in the past, so it's almost irrelevant. So throughout the whole first 3 months, the run-up to earnings, prices are trying to find a value based on what people think the stock is worth. Then the announcement comes, but it's already history, and the expectation process immediately begins again. So the market is frantically searching for the true value of its underlying asset that, you know, that you're trading, but it can never find it. The market can handle the truth, it just can never find it. So that's also something that it took me a long time to get on board. There was never an answer. You know, the market opens into the unknown and closes without answers. There's never a definitive "that's it" moment in the market.
Yeah.
And the only way you can operate in that kind of very vague and nebulous environment is to have very strict risk management tools in place. Really batten down the hatches, and the minute you see something wrong, straight for the exit.
Mm-hmm.
And you never have to really understand the market or be able to explain it to yourself. A lot of the time, I actually don't know what's going on, but it took me a while to realize you don't have to know what's going on. Now, obviously, you have the big picture and you know how to work your platform and all that. You know, that goes without saying. And like I said, people figure all that out quickly. But, you know, people often say, where do you see the market in 3 months, 6 months? I haven't a clue, Justin. Yeah, honestly, yeah. I haven't a clue.
Yeah.
You know, the last time you and I spoke, I had a very nice trade triggered there on the first day of the year, triggered on the 2nd of January. I closed it out on the 7th of March. It was a daily trend following position. I was trading a geared ETF in the States, SSO. It's a 2x gearing that tracks the S&P 500. And it produced just under 20% profit on the trade.
Mm-hmm.
But because of, I use a back-tested strategy where I take this simulated account, which is $50,000, and I risk 2% in each trade, which is risking $1,000. And I ran that back to 2006 and ran it forward to today. And I've been trading it for the past few years. And since 2006 until today, there's been 108 triggers, yeah. You know, 108 trades. And I record all of those in a spreadsheet and do them out. And I document that in the book and I update it. But that strategy triggered on the 2nd of January, gave just 19.68% profit on the 7th of March. Triggered again on the 11th of March, small profit. Triggered on the 26th of March, I took a loss, that was 2%. And it triggered again there recently on the 28th of March, and it's currently up 6.4%. Now, that's the exact same instrument, the exact same market, the exact same strategy.
Yeah.
Simple, boring, steady, but it works.
Yeah. Well, someone just said to me yesterday, asked me about a stock, and they said, what's your target price? And do you know what? You may do it in trading, but in investing, I don't have a target price, because you can't do that, because, you know, news is constantly changing. The company constantly changes. The valuation goes up. So I keep an eye on it all the time, and I see what changes, and I have to do that. And that's the way I do. I see people putting, you know, numbers up there for invest. And I even from big investment houses, broker houses, they put a 4p target on there. I said, well, that's ridiculous. Just put a round figure target on a company. How can you do that? There's so many things that could happen in the meantime. And so I keep a look at the charts. I keep a look at the news, and I keep a look at the momentum, you know, and everything. But I never put a sort of target, because for me that can really limit my upside, or it can make me encounter a loss. If I'm determined it's going to hit a certain point and it doesn't go there, then I could be, you know, hitting, having taking on a major loss. So I try and avoid targets like that. Just, yeah. And so it's about having your own system, isn't it? I mean, what else do you do?
On the targets, something very interesting, that you've raised a brilliant point there on targets. And I write that, you know, putting a target on a trade is a bit like when we were kids. We said we're all going to be millionaires when we grow up. Now, having said that, putting a target, there's more to it than that. In one of the strategies I use, I scale out of a position. When the position moves in my direction, I scale out after one average true range move to the upside from my point of entry, if it's a long position. So I have an initial target there. So I have actually three targets. One I scale out, second one I scale out, but the third one then I let run. The target is like the sky, and I just trail a stop under it. And I agree 100% with you. The two of the biggest mistakes traders make is they don't cut their losses and they don't let their winners run. Yeah. Cutting your losses is very simple, a protective stop, and that should always be a hard stop, which is an actual order sitting on your broker server, not a soft stop, which means it's a kind of a psychological stop. You know, when it gets to that, I'll trigger it. And that is a test of patience you might not possess. So I'm not one for soft stops. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to target, you just let it run. And good trending stocks, especially, always go on for longer than anyone has expected.
Do you know, absolutely. There's a stock I'm talking about at the moment, and it's called Bidstack, and it's phenomenal momentum. I say one thing people don't price into a stock is momentum. They say something's overvalued. I think, well, hang on, this is a tech company in a very hot sector of gaming and advertising. And I said every, and I'm not comparing it to one of the big caps, one of the FANG stocks. What I'm saying is, every, you know, phenomenal stock in the history, even the American markets, has always been called overvalued. Always, from Netflix to Uber to Amazon, all the way up, they've been called overvalued by somebody. And I said, so don't worry about being overvalued. Look at the momentum and look at the trend, you know, and if that carries on, you keep holding, because that's, no one ever talks about, you know, very few sort of market analysts or brokers talk about momentum, you know, and momentum plays such a big factor, doesn't it? Once it starts going in one direction, it, like you say, it'll go on for a lot longer than you realise.
It does. And the thing you need to watch, if you get into a stock like that that's in a parabolic climb, the one thing you need to keep an eye on is liquidity.
Yeah.
Because that stock will pull back. Now, the pullback, it may be a temporary pullback until it resumes its previous trend, or it may be just, you know, the show may be over.
Yeah.
You need to ensure wherever your stop is sitting that there's sufficient liquidity in that position or in that instrument to get you out at the price you want. Because when you're running for the door and your stop order is hit, so is everybody else's.
Yeah.
So there's this flood for the, you know, the proverbial fire in a movie theater where everyone rushes for the door.
Yeah.
And in terms of price and volume, if you think of price as the height of the door and volume as the width of the door, your position should never be so big that it can't get out that door. Mm-hmm. So if the stock is running and if you feel that, you know, the liquidity may not be in here for the size of the position I'm trading, then scale down some, take some money off the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, that's essential, of course. I mean, in small cap stocks. But it's like, do you know what? I said to someone yesterday, I said, this company, Bidstack, has gone crazy. And I said, listen, I know it's gone parabolic. Like you say, I did a chart yesterday and I pointed out, so it's gone parabolic here. And I said, it will have a pullback, but I just believe in this company for longer term. I want to acquire more shares in this company. It will have a major pullback. You'll find the people who bought too high start selling first. This will, you know, beget other sellers, and there'll be a sell-off, and then it'll cool down. But momentum on news they'll release, because they've only just started their business, really, on good news they'll be releasing, will pick back up again. And then you'll find those people who sold at the top will be buying again, probably a bit late, and they'll do that all the time. You know, they'll be buying, they'll be selling high buying high and selling low. And I just said, you know, it's about momentum. You got every now and again a stock comes along and it's got momentum. You know, and when it's got that, you've got to keep an eye on it. Don't just try and find another winner, another thing to trade. Stick with that one you know something about, and then go with it.
There's kind of two ways I trade stocks like that. On the short term, I take little scalps the whole way up, you know, a series of small trades the whole way upwards along. Or else I scale down my position and I have a trailing stop very far down the chart that allows maybe a 20, 30% drawback on price before you get out.
Yeah.
And most importantly, don't have all your, you know, your trading portfolio. I would recommend, I use what I call the five limits of risk. And one of those limits that's is that you would never put more than 20% of your account into any single position.
Yeah.
Because even you look at typical example, we had Johnson & Johnson there recently, and they came out with this cancer scare. The stock got hammered. Volkswagen, you remember Dieselgate?
Yeah.
Yeah, even the best blue chips, which you think are safe, can drop an absolute surprise any day. So certainly momentum stocks are great, but just be careful. I would never allocate more than 20% of your entire account in any one position, certainly in any one stock. Futures and that type of thing are a bit different. But when you're dealing with stocks, that's the only kind of caveat.
I agree. I normally say I go for 10% unless it's a very special situation that I believe is just starting to play out. But generally, generally I don't go above 10%. But unless, like I say, I think it's a special sort of a company, you know. Cool. All right. Let's mention one other thing there, Ian. You mentioned that the book is out, what is the one thing you've been asked about, you know, from people who've maybe read a bit of the book or you've been on a podcast? What's the one thing you've been asked about a lot?
I kind of had it's kind of rolling out. There was a few e-books versions out, as you said, but it's a sizable volume now. It's a fairly thick, heavy back book, and it's not a light read for the beach. You know, I set out to write something where, and as I write in it, everything you need to profit in the markets I've put into this, people can pick it up or not now is another story. We'll see. But I'm starting to get feedback, and what's standing out for people are the processes and procedures that I share, especially in relation to something like filtering stocks. If you're trading stocks, we all face the challenge every morning when we sit down is, what am I going to trade today? You go out into the market looking for certain things. And what I do is I have what I call a 9 filters process, and I push after earnings are announced each quarter. I run, and I predominantly trade the U.S. markets. I run all U.S. stocks through a filtration process, which has 9 stages. There's a general filter, and that's really about liquidity. That I know that all the stocks I'm going to trade will have sufficient liquidity to get me in and out of my position based on the account size that I trade. And I put them in sort of a stock box. It's a personal basket. And then I run them through another set of filters, which are specific to the strategies I trade. And that brings it down to maybe 100 or 200 stocks. And I then put them into a scanner where I just constantly run them through a scan. Mm-hmm. And every morning, certain technical indicators are searched for in the scan. And I'm presented with a list of stocks which are demonstrating the characteristics that I want in the morning. And I just go look at them. Mm-hmm. That might be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 stocks. And you know, someday there's nothing on the list. Mm-hmm. And that's a day for not trading.
Yeah.
Certainly for me. That's a day for backtesting, a day for writing books and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It's the day to stand aside.
Yeah.
And that filtration process, that's resonating with a lot of people because they're sometimes they might have Apple in their portfolio and then they might have a penny stock beside it. And there's no consistency between the stocks they're working with. Another one which is starting to get a lot of feedback are the records. I list 7 records that I think every trader should keep. And this isn't just a trade log of all the trades you make and the profitability of them. I also believe traders should keep a diary because it's like you can speak to yourself from the past.
Yeah.
What was I looking for and what have I learned and work on that? And actually my own, I've always... habit I had, I keep personal diaries, and the book is actually the foundation for the book was my personal diaries going back to the start, and I identified what is it, the things that I struggled with, and when I met other people, what were we all struggling with, and did I find a solution, and I matched up the problems with the solutions. I also believe that, you know, people always forget about this one, it's your equity curve, and going back to what I said about the stand-up comedian, we need to have an equity curve where at the start of the year, how much money had I in my account? At the end of the year, how much money? And if your negative curve is flat at best or negative, you need to stop trading. And you need to make a decision. Why am I even doing this? Because we all kind of get seduced by the market and we love it and it's a buzz and all that. But if you're engaged in something where you're consistently losing money, then you've entered the realm of gambling where it's about entertainment. You know, this is a business, it's a profession, it's supposed to pay the bills. And you need to say, for every hour I spend in the market, am I earning at least the minimum wage?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I should be down at Tesco, you know, not engaged with the markets. And okay, if we get a buzz from the markets, if it's gambling for us, that's fine. But at least accept that and admit that's what you're doing. Yeah. And for many of us, the allure of profit is sort of justifies the activity. If the profits aren't there, you need to say, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
And
absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Well, Ian, thank you for coming on. And like I say, you can find more of this in depth in Ian's book, Way of the Trader, A Complete Guide to the Art of Financial Trading. I'll post the link on the website. But it's well worth the read there. And Ian, hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Darren Sinden, market analyst at Pepperstone. You're right, Darren?
Yeah, not too bad, Justin. Just finding my feet after that long and very enjoyable Easter weekend.
Yeah, it was long. It just seems longer than I thought. And it's amazing. I can go away for a week on holiday and then come back. I seem to be fine. But yet, bank holidays, I come back and I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like a zombie, you know? I don't know what the heck I am. So I don't know what happened there, but I think it must be in the weather. Just a change in the heat.
I think that's it, Justin. We're not used to sort of 4 days of continuous sunshine, are we?
Especially over the bank holiday, yeah, exactly.
No, indeed not.
I mean, the odds of that happening are very slim. Cool, so, of course, a market analyst you'll be looking at. So what's the first thing you want to chat about, Dan? What are you looking at?
Well, as your listeners will remember, we started the US Q1 earnings season just before Easter, and we're now well into that with quite a large number of major US companies having reported already, and more due to report today, including the likes of Microsoft, Facebook, Visa, AT&T and Boeing. So some pretty big names and some pretty topical ones.
How's it been going so far? What's the readout?
Well, actually, it's been pretty good. I mean, you know, Lockheed would be a particularly good example of that. Yesterday, they smashed earnings, and the stock appreciated dramatically. It was up over 6% at one point during the day. And
Who's that? You say which company is that?
Lockheed Martin.
Oh, Lockheed Martin. Okay, yeah.
Defence and aerospace.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So they beat comfortably, and the market liked what they heard. So they really led the rally in US stocks yesterday. And of course, although they only edged up slightly, US equities actually reached new all-time highs on the day. Immediately on the I wouldn't put people off of thinking that. But what's interesting is that literally on the back of that, JP Morgan have come out with an equity strategy note today, focusing on the US and in particular the prospects for US earnings. And contrary to most people on the street, they actually think that we'll see an improvement in earnings over this quarter in the S&P 500 stocks, and quite a significant improvement in earnings. They're talking about a 4-5% improvement in EPS when most other analysts were feeling quite negative. And in fact, the most bearish were looking for a 4% fall in earnings per share, when we look at the index as a whole. So that's quite a bold call. And they say on top of that they think the earnings momentum that would generate will reinvigorate growth and investor sentiment around that. And maybe we saw some of that in the performance of US equities yesterday. Now what's interesting as well is that they say that US and Asian business cycles are now in recovery mode, and there's a whole list of quantitative indicators in the piece, but net, they think that we've seen the bottom, and that there are now sort of green shoots of expansion again after a bit of a slowdown.
Yeah, who's this? Sorry, who's this? Saying?
This is JP Morgan.
And are they, and basically, I don't know what you said to start there, but are they on their own in this, or are other people sort of echoing their sentiments?
Well, I mean, we certainly heard other people talk about, UBS would be amongst them talking about, but there's the cycle bottoming out and the green shoots of recovery. UBS have been focusing on the idea that the stimulus from Beijing is feeding through into the Chinese economy. And we have, to be fair, seen some hints of that. What's interesting is that JP Morgan mentioned both the US and the Asian business cycles in their piece. But we've got an early window on whether they're right or wrong coming up this Friday when we have US GDP data for the first quarter of 2020. 19. Now, this is the very early, the preliminary read. So it's not the final figure by any means, and it will be. We'll see a number of other reads throughout, and the data will be subject to revision, no doubt. But in the last couple of days, I've been looking at some models and now casting data, which suggests that we might be in for a pleasant surprise. Now, the market's forecasting US GDP growth for Q1 of 1.8%. That's quite a long way below the 2.2% that we saw in the final quarter of 2018. But what I will say is that some of these now casting models, which look at leading indicators and other data that are released in real time and try and build an assessment of what the GDP figures will look like when they're finally published, they're more bullish than that. And the one that I follow most closely, the Atlanta Fed GDP now model, is actually predicting growth of 2.8%. Now, this is a guesstimate at best, so I don't think we should read too much into that. But it could be that we do see a number on Friday that's above the market's general 1.8%. And if we got, say, a 2% growth number, then that would be pretty bullish for the US economy. It might not be quite so bullish, interestingly, for US stocks, at least in the first instance, because of course if the US economy is continuing to performing and is outperforming, then maybe the Fed will have to go back to the drawing board at some stage and consider tightening again, and that might be slightly negative for US equities in the first instance. But net, I think it would overall be seen as positive if we did get a beat on GDP. One slight caveat though, and you know, JP Morgan are generally on the bull tack here, but they haven't raised their S&P 500 price target. They've set that at 3,000 and they've left it there despite this note out today. So there is some upside according to them in US equities, but it may not extend beyond 3,000 in the case of the S&P 500. And of course, you know, you can see why they picked that number. It's a psychologically important target, isn't it? A round number and a point at which many people, I imagine, will be looking to try and fade the rally and pick a top. Not that picking tops and bottoms is typically a successful trading strategy, but
can do it. It's a very successful, but no one can do it. That's the trouble. So yeah. We're at 2,933 right now. So they haven't gone above 3,000, they reckon.
No.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Interesting.
Not for the balance of 2019 at the moment. No.
Okay. What's it's very interesting. It's amazing how fast sentiment has changed. I mean, a couple of months ago, everyone was talking about the yield curve, the recession's coming definitely in 2020, maybe 2019, and now that's off the table now. But surely not. I mean. If people have pulled investment and all that, I mean, a downturn takes a while to happen, doesn't it? We are at the end of a cycle. How long can this cycle go on for? That's what I'm thinking.
For a while longer. I mean, you know, we're in the 11th year of economic growth in the US, but there are precedents. I think we have had, if you look back far enough, at least one or two expansions that were slightly longer. So there could be legs on the air. And of course, this is the first expansion in which we had such loose monetary policy. Yes. And so much money pumped into the economy, and I think it's probably we're almost in uncharted territory here. Plus, as I've also been exploring, looking at the prospects for the non-farm payrolls data that are out next week, you know, wage growth in the US is still relatively modest compared to what we might otherwise think of as a very tight labour market. So some of the pressures on US businesses in terms of costs are not there, or not perhaps there as they might be in a previous cycle. And so there is probably room to expand further. But I also, Justin, like to look at the long-term averages, things like PE data for the US indices, and to be absolutely fair, the S&P is still trading well above those kind of averages. So just to sort of let your listeners know, the S&P is roughly trading on a 16.8 forward multiple for 1 year, and that is well above the 5-year average, which is 16.4, but perhaps more importantly, well above the 10-year average multiple of 14.7. So investors are effectively paying more to get less as things stand at the moment. And that's probably why this this earnings season is so important, because if those valuations are to be justified, then we do need to see US companies step up to the plate and deliver earnings growth. And more than that, Justin, growth on both the top line and the bottom line, and ideally without any balance sheet jiggery pokery, because of course buybacks are very popular at the moment, reducing the number of shares outstanding, and that of course by default pushes earnings per share higher, just because there's more, the money has to be divided up among less individual shareholders. But if we can see,
that's what I've always thought. I mean, it sounds odd. A lot of companies do this, and they say, well, I know Buffett likes it when companies do this, because they say, if you can't find another investment and they think their own company's stock is cheap, then why not buy your own company stock? But it is a bit of a call on that side and that metric, isn't it? It's a bit of a smoke and mirrors.
I think so, and it also says to me that maybe your business model has reached its peak at that point. If you can't find anything to do, you can't get a better return on your capital than buying and stock back. And I'm also concerned when people borrow money to do that. And of course, that's been tempting for many companies with interest rates so low that they can borrow money at just a few percentage points longer term, buy back their stock. Delete it, boost their share price, and everybody pats them on the back. But of course, at some point, those debts will have to be repaid. And if they're doing well now, that's fine. But what about 5-10 years time? Some of this debt falls due. If we're in the midst of a downturn at that point, will they find it that easy to service and repay that debt? We can't know that, of course, because we haven't got a crystal ball. But you have to think that borrowing money to buy back your own stock seems a bit of a strange move.
Yeah, you're right. If you're borrowing money, no one ever advises a private investor borrow money to invest in stock. So why do you think as a company should do it? It just doesn't make economic sense. Do you know what? Looking at the S&P chart, actually, very interesting. We're now at exactly pretty much the level where it topped out at in September before the big sell-off. So and it had a big rise yesterday. So it'd be interesting to see it gets above this with conviction. We are overbought on the RSI, relative strength. So we'll see how far it goes here. I mean, if it has a pullback and drops further or just consolidates. But it's an interesting level,
It is. My own thought is that we'll probably we could consolidate a little bit from here, but if we were to look out towards the end of the year, and it's a famous last word sometimes to predict things 8 months ahead, I would have thought that equities will be at this level or slightly higher at that point, or running into towards the end of the year. It's difficult to call it, as I say, but just because there aren't too many alternatives or attractive alternatives at the moment. The one perhaps that might show its hand over the summer months into the autumn could be Europe. If we saw some kind of upturn in the European economy, although that doesn't look very likely at the moment, then of course there's been a pretty big underperformance of European stocks against US stocks over the last sort of 18 months to 2 years. And of course, most fund managers like to get into a turning point, a contrarian trade as it becomes more mainstream. So that could be the market perhaps to keep an eye on over in the next couple of quarters. European equities, can we see an upturn? But for the moment, the data from Europe is still pretty depressing, I must say. We had poor business confidence data from France this morning, weak IFO data out of Germany today. So the survey data, at least, is a bit negative. That said, there was some better news for Spain. So it's not, it's not dreadful across the board, but I always see Germany as a barometer for the whole of Europe. And while their manufacturing sector continues to struggle, I can't get enthusiastic about Europe for the moment.
But the thing is, when you have the Germany, recorded the engine of Europe, and that engine is stalling, of course there's going to be repercussions, aren't there? So it's not good for anyone. It's not good for us. But I know people sort of tend to like to rejoice in the fact that Europe, if they're anti-European, that Europe is suffering. But let's be honest, it's our biggest trading partner, so it's not good for us.
The truth is, in a global economy, we need most people to be moving in the same direction where possible, because things are so interconnected. Just if I may, Justin, speaking about interconnected economies, I just want to flag one thing from the other side of the globe, Australia. They had inflation data for the first quarter out last night, and unfortunately, that fell to 1.3%. which was well below forecast of 1.5, and prior read for the last quarter of 2018 of 1.8%. Now, that sounds like it's good news for consumers, and perhaps in the short term it may be, but the Reserve Bank of Australia, the country's central bank, warned only a couple of weeks ago that if inflation continued to fall, whilst unemployment picked up, and in fact unemployment did pick up slightly last month, then they might be closer to considering a rate cut to support their economy. Now, Australia hasn't had a recession for well over 26 years, and they're not likely to move into one now. But sentimentally, that's certainly weighed on the stock market and the currency. Now, the currency's down by around 1.84% over the last week against the US dollar. Interestingly, though, at the same time, Australian stocks have risen to 11-year highs. So it's a big export, of course. So a weaker currency tends to boost the Aussie equities in the same way that sterling, you know, falling tends to boost the FTSE 100 here. But it's an interesting, you know, thing to keep an eye on. We've got an RBA meeting on the 7th of May coming up. I don't know that they'll make a change to rates at that meeting, not least because there are general elections in Australia on the 18th of May. So they'll probably sit on their hands for now, but they may say more about, you know, what would finally make them pull the trigger. Anyway, for now, the currency down, the stock market up. At some point, that you'd like to think that that would spin about and that there'll be a trading opportunity there. But certainly a market to watch, even if you, you know, you're not directly interested in the Australian economy. It could be one to watch. It could be a sort of a, how should we say, a parable of what could happen in other economies.
Yeah, yeah, marvellous stuff. Anything else, Daz, or is that it for this week?
Well, you know, you've got to watch sterling back below 129 today. Is, you know, we haven't had too much concrete comment on Brexit since Parliament reconvened yesterday, but this is very much sentiment driven. I suppose we'll drift in the absence of any hard and fast news about what the next steps are there. So keep your eye on that. You know, how low can sterling go? And as I said earlier, you know, as sterling falls, it should typically be better for exporters, and that's the UK 100 index. Although for the moment, I think I'm right in saying that UK stocks are down on the day. Yeah, the FTSE is down by around 0.43%. So maybe we'll see a bounce in that a little bit later on today or across the rest of the week. So that's really what's got my eye for the moment. Let's see what the US data comes out like on Friday. That will set the sentiment, I think. And just watch these big US stocks that are reporting today and across the rest of the week, as you know, particularly what they say about the next quarter, because that will drive sentiment towards US stocks. There's no doubt about that.
Marvellous stuff. And I think, you know, Trump will do his best, whatever happens. When is it? Is it next year, the elections, is it?
2020. Actually, yeah. on the subject of the US, don't forget as well that trade negotiations with the Chinese kick off again today in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin's gone on this particular trip. So I don't suppose he would be flying all the way to Beijing if he didn't think there was some realistic prospect of
because there have been several, you know, layers, hasn't there? I mean, he is one step down from the big man himself, so I suppose it's going to be pretty important. And of course, Trump and Xi will only meet up to do the actual signing, really, won't they? So
yes, of course,
you know, yes. All deal would have to be done before they meet up. Cool, Morris, Daz, speak next week, fella.
Thank you, Justin. Have a good week.
All right, it's time for the top five most followed companies. They are at five: Zenanga Iron Ore Company. Down 1% at the moment, ZIOC ticker there. At four, Brave Bison Group, and Claire, the ex-CEO, is selling down his stock. That's why the price is taking a bit of a tumble at the moment. She's still 5 mil. That's what, 17 mil left, I think, 18 mil left. So a couple of days worth of selling left yet. At three, Diurnal Group, DNL. I did have those on my watch list for a while. I have no idea. I just took them straight back off. It's got the stage where my watch list grew too big. And I thought, unless I know the company intimately, I'm not just going to follow them. I'll take them off. So I took them off. I'll have to revisit, maybe. At two, MX Oil, MXO. And number one most followed company is Centamin. Up 9% a day as CEY ticker. All right, top five most liked RNSs. It's quite quiet, I thought, this morning. But here are the RNSs. Ascent Resources, placing to raise 750 grand. Sunrise Resources, project updates. At three, OptiBiox Health, Slimbiome, medical launches in UK market. At 2, Westminster Group, new $3.48 million USD contract in Asia. And number 1, Boohoo Group, final results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchus appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.